Sarah from The Journey and welcome to The Weekly. Now, I don't know about you, but I never seem to have quite enough hours in the day to fit everything in, and I certainly don't seem to have enough hours in the day to read all the interesting things that are out there. We thought we probably weren't alone in this, so we created The Weekly, which is a condensed version of all the key things we've been looking at over the last week or so in an easy, digestible podcast form that you can listen to on the go. Now, you might be wondering, if you're new to us, what even is The Journey? Well, we are dedicated to bringing you the latest science and evidence-based research around everything to do with conception, pregnancy, and the early years of a little person's life. The reality is, the world looks very different from the one that existed even just 10, 15 years ago, but in many cases, the advice we're given hasn't changed. There's a lot of fake news out there as well, so we're dedicated to bringing you practical things you can do, most crucially, all backed by science. So, without further ado, what is on offer this week? Interestingly enough, there have been quite a few hard-hitting pieces of research to drop over the last couple of weeks, so we're going to be looking at four of them. First up, the latest research around safe baby sleep. Obviously, any new parent knows how much of an anxious time it is. The first few months, especially when it comes to sleep, if you're anything like me, you'd be checking your child every 5 minutes. But this one bit of research shows us an easy thing that we can do in order to improve that. Next up, there's been some research out around sperm, and specifically going against the notion that aging really only affects women. Actually, what we're learning is that it does affect male sperm, but there are some things you can do to offset that, so we'll be going through that. Next up, a pretty alarming piece of research out around frozen embryos, which is obviously used when you freeze your eggs or when you obviously go through the process of IVF, and that leading to some potential health implications for the child. We're going to be delving beneath those scary headlines and with some insight from Mahantesh Qureshi, which is actually pretty reassuring. And then finally, we're all into allergies here at The Journey. And the latest bit of research is another big tick, something you can do if your child is at risk. It has been showing good results in recent published research. So let's get going. Okay, safe baby sleeping. Pretty much one of the main priorities for a new parent, especially as research shows that the first year is the most risky time, and especially the first 6 months of a new baby's life. Now, against that, of course, all of us do want our little ones to sleep well, and there has been quite a rise in innovative sleep solutions for new babies. But recent research, which we're going to be talking about, suggests that a particular form, which is known as an inclined sleeper, so basically anything that's not flat, is a major, major avoid. And we're going to be having a look at exactly what the research has found and why. So taking a step back, the Safety Commission in the US, which is actually the Consumer Product Safety Commission, has spoken out with a report over the last couple of weeks really warning people against baby sleeping products that have an incline of more than 10 degrees. And this is really a reaction to a number of deaths. And an independent report conducted by a PhD really showing that, looking specifically, monitoring movements and oxygen levels in babies between 2 and 6 months old and inclined sleepers versus flat sleepers. And the absolute bottom line here, the report has strongly shown that anything with an incline should be avoided completely. Now, it may seem like a strange result. Why is an incline such a problem? Now, what the research showed is that these inclined sleepers basically allows babies to move very differently versus when they're on a firm, a flat mattress. And this could essentially allow babies to roll onto their stomachs more easily, which we know from a lot of research is absolutely not what you want your baby to be doing when they're very young. Now, when the babies did roll over, the research showed that they exerted nearly 250% more muscle activity, oxygen levels dropped twice as much, and the study showed that even a 10 or 20 degree incline poses a risk. So basically, it's not worth it. So taking all of this in a very simple nutshell, what do you do for safer sleeping? Well, really, it's pretty simple. Now, as appealing as some of these fancy sleeping products can seem and look, they should just be completely avoided. And the American Association of Pediatrics strongly supports this. And they reiterate is that there is no such thing as a safe infant inclined sleeper. And actually, all you should be looking at is anything that has an infant sleeping flat on their backs. So they need to sleep alone, unrestrained, on a firm flat surface and free of padding, bumpers and other soft bedding. So it really is a pretty simple message. Stick to flat and avoid these products pretty much completely. And if you do want to see a lot more on the research behind sudden infant death syndrome and all the other tips and tricks you can do in order to reduce risk, check out thejourneydot.com. Next up is another one for the boys. Now, we know that on average, sperm is under fire these days. And this is not just for a few people, it's for a lot of us. On average, sperm counts are down 50% in only 40 years. The question is, what's actually causing this? And most importantly, what can we do about it? After all, it very much takes two people to tango, and that involves the men as well. Now, we look in this next segment at one of the main culprits and a surprising bonus way you can give it a helping hand. So, let's take a step back. There are two old school misconceptions when it comes to difficulty with a conception. One is that when it comes to fertility, it's only women that are really hurt by aging. Number two, if there's a problem, it's likely on the female side. Now, traditionally, men have gotten off quite lightly when it comes to scrutiny around problems with conception. However, science is increasingly pointing to this being absolutely the wrong approach. Now, what we now know is the following. According to research from one of the leading IVF centres in the world, male ageing does matter. And as much as 50% of the reason for infertility is actually due to the male side. As we said, sperm counts are down on average about 50% over 40 years. And we also know the male side can play a role in repeated miscarriage. We've got a lot more on that on the site from one of our expert advisors. Now, as always, there's absolutely no point looking at all the negatives. Instead, we want to look at what the latest science suggests is behind this. And most importantly, we want to look at the science-backed positive things you can do about it. So here's what you need to know about sperm protection. Now, a lot of the latest research, particularly around the impact of us all getting older before we have kids, relates to a specific damage on sperm. And this is something known as DNA fragmentation. So it's basically when the DNA within the sperm gets damaged. Now, what causes sperm DNA fragmentation? Now, we have got an absolute in-depth piece all about this, which actually relates a lot to something called oxidative stress. We look at what it does, why it's a problem. But in a nutshell, as always, there are many, many causes to why we get this oxidative stress and why we get this damage, and they can often be in combination. So what we're going to do is look at some of the major culprits and, as I said, most importantly, what you can do about it. Now, one of the major factors that plays a role is male aging. So research has shown that for every year increase in male age, there's a decline of about 4% in the odds of a birth. Now, this is less than the case for women who face a decline of about 9%, but it does go to show that age is a factor for male fertility, despite some of the previous thinking that men are far less impacted. And as we said, the main way that aging impacts is through DNA fragmentation. Now, as much as we'd all like a time machine, there is nothing you can do about aging for now. However, you can do some things potentially around some of the other factors that exacerbate this DNA fragmentation. And as always, we want to focus on the positive things you can do. And the good news is that there are really lots of things you can do. And in fact, one study suggested that lifestyle modification is the most fundamental, important, simple, and easy way to improve sperm quality. Good news. Okay, so we're going to break down each of the ways that you can make this a little bit better. Now, some of these may seem like quite basic, obvious things, except the last one we'll get to perhaps. But making an effort with these factors can really be a powerful way to reduce your risk of damage. First one, super obvious, avoid cigarette smoke. It's a massive, massive culprit when it comes to oxidative stress. Also avoid airborne pollutants whenever you can and excessive drinking. Pretty much goes without saying, but always worth a reminder. Next up is heat, so too much working out in tight clothes. So you might want to give that lycra a miss. It really does make a difference according to research. Thing is, sperm storage is outside of the body for a reason. It needs to be cooler. So when you're working out a lot in very tight clothes, over a period of time, that heat does build up. Also applies to loose underwear. And then exercise, even in itself, is important. It's the Goldilocks approach, as always. Not too much, not too little. Moderation is always your friend. And once again, as a reminder, unfortunately, excessive cycling, science does suggest, can be damaging. So sorry to all those very keen cyclists out there. Then it's weight management. So high BMI is linked to damage, which again comes back to moderate exercise being the best thing to do. And then radiation. So avoid working with your laptop on your lap. They should have really called laptops something else. And we've got a whole load of stuff on the site about other things you can do to avoid radiation. Now, the last one is a bit of a curveball and actually may be welcomed. And this is where it gets really interesting. So research suggests that ejaculation every other day may actually be the best bet to reduce sperm DNA fragmentation. So this is another reason why it's best to have sex ideally every other day if you're trying to conceive. So storing it up and going long periods of time and waiting for the right time is definitely not the right approach. You want to be getting going pretty much every other day if you can. Next up, what about antioxidants? Now, we know that oxidative stress for DNA fragmentation in sperm is not good. We also know that antioxidants are a good way to tackle this. So the question is, what, how, and where? As usual, it's never super simple because you, once again, it's Goldilocks. You don't want too little or too much. However, basic antioxidants like vitamin C, which you'll obviously know about, something called CoQ10, which is, we've got a lot more on the site about that as well, or something called N-acetylcysteine, which basically helps the body produce its own antioxidants, is one way to go. Now, as a reminder, we always say this, but always talk to your doctor before starting a supplement. It's really, really important. Now, what does the science say about these antioxidants? Well, one bit of analysis, which pulled together over 30 studies over 13 years, concluded that vitamin C, selenium, CoQ10, N-acetylcysteine, zinc were effective in actually helping protect from some form of DNA fragmentation. But there are other physiological factors that can contribute, so having diabetes, STIs, and also a particular condition where you have enlarged veins, typically within the scrotum, that should be diagnosed by a doctor, could be another factor. So if you are concerned about your swimmers, the first port of call, as always, is your doctor. Now, one other curveball here is intermittent fasting. Now, this has become something that's super, super popular amongst the health conscious of us for all the benefits it can have from an aging perspective. Now, as a reminder, intermittent fasting is when, as the name suggests, you have a period of time of fasting. It can either be something like 5-2, which is 5 days of normal eating, 2 days of very low calorie intake, or something like a 16-8, which is eating during 8 hours of a 24-hour period and fasting for the remaining 16. Now, why is this relevant to sperm DNA? Well, intermittent fasting has shown some benefit against oxidative stress, which again is one of the culprits for DNA fragmentation in sperm. Now, the question is, can intermittent fasting really help make a difference? Now, the absolute honest answer is we don't know too much at this stage about sperm specifically, but intermittent fasting in itself has shown some benefit reducing oxidative stress overall. And interestingly, it's shown a protective factor specifically for lipids, which is very important for sperm. So we do not have too much direct research on this point, but something interesting to think about. Now, how do you know if your sperm is affected? So if you are struggling to conceive or you've had miscarriage, it is absolutely worth getting your sperm checked. However, it is worth being mindful of getting this done properly. You do have to be a bit careful if you're using some of these at-home testing kits. And also be mindful that DNA fragmentation is not usually considered when it comes to initial testing. The first port of call will be traditional analysis. So that looks at the morphology, which is the shape, count, and the motility. So basically what direction and how they're moving. And speak to your doctor about this. Now, one thing to know, as we said, is that most tests will not include a DNA fragmentation test at the outset. So why would you take a deeper dive? Now, obviously, if you're older or you've suffered from more than one miscarriage, getting this tested is absolutely something you should insist on talking about with your doctor, because research has shown as many as 15% of people have shown normal results using the traditional screen and then still suffer with infertility. So testing DNA fragmentation, which measures the quality of sperm as a DNA package carrier, may give further clues to the picture. Now, what your doctor will be looking for is for damage to be below 30%. So above that suggests that this may well be the cause of issues and it will need to be addressed. So if in doubt, speak to your doctor. Always speak to your doctor before taking any supplements. And do check out lots more information on thejourneydot.com. Next up, we would really like to address a bit of a scary headline that's come up this week around the use of frozen embryos and some links to childhood cancer. Now, these headlines are obviously pretty shocking, so we wanted to dig into the research and the report behind it and speak to our resident expert, Mahantesh Qureshi, who's a consultant gynecologist obstetrician, and really like caveat this and go through it and see how concerned should we be. So, taking a step back, a report issued this week showed increased risk of cancer for children born from frozen embryo transfer. Now, as we said, this is a pretty scary headline, and if you want to look at the research directly, it's up on our site. But this headline is one thing, but as always, the devil is in the detail, and often beneath the headline, there is more to the story. And this is what we want to dig into today. So, absolute number one thing is that Mahantesh believes couples using frozen embryos or children born from them should absolutely not panic. And this is why. First up, yes, it's a large and carefully analysed study, but there is a few major caveats which we're going to go through. Number one, putting it all into perspective. The number of cancer cases reported was very small. Only 14 in total out of a huge number. And the reality is there is a possibility that this has occurred by chance or due to some unknown factors. And that is a very high chance. And we will go through why a bit further on. Now, with science, medicine and research, it's rarely straightforward. There are often many, many different factors that can influence an outcome. Mahantesh argues that explaining and agreeing on an outcome to measure a study against is very, very complicated. And he points out that in this particular bit of research, there are over 200 confounders, which are basically elements that can influence a result. So that is a lot of other elements in the mix that could vary and could lead to a specific result, i.e. cancer in this case. I mean, you only need to open the Daily Mail to find out how many lifestyle factors have been linked to causing cancer. The other point to remember is that childhood cancer is extremely rare, and that's a good thing. Less than one case per 10,000 births. So even with the headline, which is a doubling of a number, it's a very tiny number, so it remains very rare. Now, to put this into perspective, it's far rarer than illnesses caused by genetic problems, which affect around 2% of pregnancies. And paternal smoking has been shown to pretty much double childhood cancer rates in spontaneous conceptions anyway. So as a reminder on the absolute number, there was only 2 in 500 babies resulting from frozen embryo transfer and 1 in 500 resulting from fresh embryo transfer that has had a diagnosis of cancer in this report. So more needs to be done. Now, the next interesting thing is the technology around frozen embryo transfer has moved on a lot since this study was done. Now, Mahantesh makes the point that almost all aspects of freezing technology and embryo culture have changed since the study period, And importantly, freezing technology has significantly improved, particularly around embryo survival rates. The other thing to remember is that modern freezing techniques like vitrification, which is also known as flash freezing, are biologically very different versus the slow freezing techniques that we used for most of the period that this study covers. The other thing we need to remember is there is another side of the argument. You know what they say, there are always two sides, and here's the other side. The ability to freeze embryos has actually offered some pretty substantial benefits for couples with fertility problems. So number one is effectively remove the risk for ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which basically means there are less multiple births, more one at a time, and that just inherently avoids the risk, reduces the risk of prematurity. Secondly, embryo freezing also essentially freezes in time the mother's age at the point at which the embryos were created. And that reduces things like chromosomal abnormalities, which comes with age, and which, as we said earlier, actually account for a much greater percentage of issues in children born today. Finally, there is evidence that the birth weight of babies born from frozen cycles is higher than with fresh IVF. It actually looks closer to that of babies conceived naturally. And remember, low birth weight can be associated with health problems in later life. So in fact, frozen transfer cycles may offer lifetime health benefits in addition to those negative claims that are being outlined here. So there's always a balancing act. So what's the conclusion? Well, Mahantesh does say that clearly more research needs to be done, but his bottom line is that the results presented in the research should not alarm couples undergoing frozen embryo transfers or children born from this technique, because it is certainly not as clear-cut as the headline suggests, and there are many positives on the other side. So if you've been concerned, please don't be. There is always another side, and the devil is usually in the detail, and we've got some more stuff up on the site if you'd like to read further about this. Okay, so lastly, it's about allergies and the latest research that's out about something we can potentially do in order to reduce the risk of allergies occurring in at-risk children. Now, you don't need me or a team of scientists to tell you that allergies in young kids are rapidly on the rise. It just takes a bit of looking around to tell you this. I mean, even when I look at my son's nursery and this week, when there was a request to make snacks after his nativity play, the list of ingredients that could not be incorporated will just go to show how much this is an issue nowadays. And in fact, according to data published by the New England Journal of Medicine, peanut allergies among children in Western countries have nearly doubled in the past 10 years. And clearly this is not just a case of better diagnosis. But we're all about using science to do something about this and not just the scary headlines. And in fact, the latest science is suggesting early introduction to some of these common allergens may help. So here's what you need to know. Now, we have previously written quite a lot on the site about benefits shown by research looking at early introduction of allergens like peanut and eggs versus complete elimination and avoidance between 4 to 6 months of age. And we've got a lot more up on the site about that. Now, the latest research out this week from King's College London and published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology suggests some pretty positive results in terms of prevention from introducing some common allergens to children at risk as early as 3 months old. Now, it goes without saying, but we will say it anyway, you should always speak to your doctor first and work out together the best protocol for introducing foods to a child who may be at risk of developing an allergy. Do this before you do anything else. We insist on it. However, a recent review of all the published early intervention trials that have happened so far did conclude that early egg or peanut introduction to a child at risk of allergy was associated with lower risk of then developing an allergy. So this idea of early introduction definitely seems to be worth a discussion with your doctor at least. Now, what factors might mean that your child is at risk of developing an allergy? Now, the study at King's focused on children who were at higher risk of developing an allergy, and they focused on three factors based on research. Number one, early onset eczema. Number 2, non-white ethnicity. And number 3, early onset sensitization to a food. Now, they used a skin prick test, but this could be if your child is reactive to things that you've eaten when you're breastfeeding, for example. I think that is quite a common one. And of course, although this wasn't included in the research, other factors include a family history of allergies and food intolerances. Now, question is, what did the research show in terms of prevention? Now, the trial was with around 1,300 infants, and they did understandably have some challenges, I should say, getting people to stick to the terms of the trial, because obviously it's quite hard getting a child of 3 months of age to eat egg and nuts. However, in those that did stick to the test, there were some interesting results. Number one, nearly 35% of the group of infants at risk who were not doing the test went on to develop an allergy, versus just 19% of those that were introduced these allergens early. So that's clearly quite a difference. When it came to peanut allergy, those who were not introduced early, 33 of them went on to develop an allergy to peanuts. Now, the ones that were introduced early, just 14% went on to develop this allergy. So once again, quite a big difference. Now, on the egg side, it's even more stark. Nearly 50% of the group that were not introduced to it early developed an allergy, versus just 20% of those who were introduced to the allergen early. So it does look as though babies at risk of developing an allergy did benefit from early introduction to these solids. Now, the question is, what do the current allergy guidelines suggest? Now, the current National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease guidelines propose introduction of peanut from around 6 months. So once again, this is just for information purposes only, and it's intended to be used as a discussion point for conversations with your doctor. If you are concerned that your child has an allergy, it is so, so important that you go and strike up a conversation with your doctor about how to approach it. Now, for more on allergies, we've got some of our expert speakers who've done podcasts. So we've got Dr. Mona Amin, who's done one, and then we've got another one with Dr. Natasha Campbell-McBride, and we will be publishing a new one very shortly. So please do check out the material on the site, as well as the links to the research, and please feel free to use them for discussions with your doctor. We hope it helps.